The U.S. planning to seize half of Afghanistan's frozen fund, just as the World Health Organization is warning about massive food insecurity and disease threatening the people. In Lebanon, the army urges the United Nations to stop Israel from using the Lebanese airspace to strike neighboring Syria. Plus, Western countries asking their citizens to leave Ukraine immediately over an imminent Russian invasion. Moscow is calling it an information war. This is World News. I'm Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with Afghanistan, the Taliban slamming its theft and executive order by U.S. President that allows Washington to seize half of the Afghan funds frozen in Federal Reserve. A Taliban spokesman says that this represents the lowest level of human and moral decay of the country. Under the order, half of the $7 billion of Afghan assets held in the U.S. could be used to compensate families of 9/11 victims. The other half can be released for humanitarian aid to the country. The move on the funds is pending a judicial decision. A senior U.S. official says it will take months to unfreeze funds for aid to Afghanistan, and this as rights groups and the U.N. have warned of a worsening humanitarian crisis in the country. The WHO, meantime, is raising the alarm about a growing measles outbreak in Afghanistan that's in the grip of a humanitarian disaster. WHO says measles cases have been increasing in all provinces since the end of July last year. They have jumped by 18% in January when tens of thousands were infected and more than 150 people killed. The organization says that some 90% of the cases and fatalities were children under the age of five. The WHO is warning that deaths from measles would increase further in the coming weeks. The situation is more concerning as the country is grappling with widespread food insecurity and malnutrition. That makes children even more vulnerable to the disease. The United Nations has warned that half of the Afghan population is threatened with food shortages. Well, on that note, I talked to author and political commentator John Stepling, and he says it's an illegal act on the part of the U.S. to freeze Afghan assets. He says Washington is doing so in clear negligence of impacts on the lives of the Afghan people.
It's nakedly illegal. You can't legally freeze these funds. But the U.S. treats countries like Afghanistan as their possessions. These are like geopolitical possessions that they trade around and so forth. They don't care that people are dying. They have never cared people are dying. And you can certainly look at U.S. foreign policy for 80 years and see that that's in no way hyperbole. They simply don't care. And the justification that they are withholding funds, always, there's a lot of sort of diplomat speak around this freezing of funds having to do with women's rights in Afghanistan. You won't have to worry about that if 80% of the people are dead. It's just nakedly sadistic and cruel. The measles outbreak will be the first of many such outbreaks of diseases of insanitation and malnutrition.
A senior Iranian security official is stressing that his country will never forgo its right to further develop peaceful nuclear potential. The secretary of the Supreme National Security Council says that the retention and boosting of peaceful nuclear potential, as well as defense capabilities, are options that will never be taken off the table. In his tweet, Ali Champani also says Iran's regional policies contribute to the establishment of security. He recalled people's mass turnout in the rallies on Friday, marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He said that the huge participation indicates popular support for the establishment. Now, those comments were made as Iran continues talks with the remaining parties to the 2015 deal to revive the accord. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homa Lesgi, earlier joined us with an update on the talks between Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries in Vienna.
today, this morning, we heard that the head of Iran's delegation, Ali Bagheri-Kani, was meeting the Russian delegation led by Mikhail Ulyanov. Yesterday, there were a string of meetings between Iran and the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora, between Iran and the Chinese delegation. And also, we had all three expert working groups meeting separately. The meetings all together took hours and hours yesterday on the three issues of nuclear commitments by Iran, sanctions lifting, and also sequencing or implementation. So all of the issues that are up for discussion covered yesterday in intensive discussions. The Russian ambassador, Mikhail Ulyanov, said that today these, in his words, intensive diplomatic efforts will continue. And he also said that he had an in-depth discussion with the EU coordinator on how, in his words, a final document may look like. He'd said previously, after meeting the American representative, Rob Malley, that he believed that things were definitely moving ahead. So what we're hearing from the Iranian side, the foreign minister, Iranian foreign minister Amir Abdullahian, quoted as saying that Iran is optimistic about the future and hopes that all the parties will return to their commitments. What are we hearing from the other side? American officials have also been cited as saying that they believe an agreement that would address the concerns of all parties is in sight.
Now, when it comes to the war on Yemen, the UAE, that's part of the satellite coalition, is not holding back. While the Yemeni army has begun a new retaliatory campaign against the UAE, the Sheikh Kingdom has increased its purchase of military hardware. The next report looks at Abu Dhabi's involvement in the Yemen war and whether the new Yemeni operations will force the Sheikh Kingdom to change its course.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating lands from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE, Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support.
Now, Abu Dhabi is scrambling to boost its air defenses following a string of Yemeni attacks on the UAE's vital infrastructure. It's following the footsteps of Saudi Arabia and is turning to Western powers like the United States to supply it with military hardware and weapons. But reports suggest that Riyadh is running critical low on ammunition to keep its missile systems operational.
The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Now moving on, Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says that the country won't, under U.S. pressure, abandon its maritime rights in a dispute with Israel. Senior Hezbollah official Sheikh Ali Damush says that the U.S., through mediating the Israel-Lebanon talks, is attempting to hold Beirut to ransom. He says by misusing the economic crisis in the country, the U.S. is also trying to put pressure on Lebanon and get concessions. The Hezbollah official also accuses Washington of making attempts to make Lebanon normalize relations with Tel Aviv. But he stressed that Hezbollah rejects any normalization with enemies. Beirut and Tel Aviv have long been locked in a dispute over their economic zones in the Mediterranean Sea and hydrocarbon exploration there. On Thursday, the U.S. urged Lebanon to settle the dispute and said that it was the last minute for an agreement. Bahrain confirmed that an Israeli officer will be stationed in the tiny Persian Gulf country. Bahraini foreign minister says that the appointment is related to an international coalition of more than 34 countries. The unnamed coalition aims to secure freedom of navigation in the region's waters and confront piracy and terrorism. This is the first time that an Israeli military officer is posted to an Arab country. According to Israeli media, a naval officer will serve as a liaison for the U.S. 5th Fleet garrisoned in Bahrain. And that follows an unannounced visit to the kingdom by Israeli Minister of Military Affairs last week. Manama and Tel Aviv normalized ties 2 years ago under a U.S. brokered agreement. That triggered a wave of public protest against the deal and in support of Palestine. Now, in other news, Russia accusing NATO of beating the drums of war by spreading lies about an imminent Russian invasion of Ukraine. The foreign ministry says that the West has launched an unprecedented media campaign to convince the international community about a military offensive on Ukraine. The ministry says that Western media is participating in what it calls a full-scale information war against Russia. The United States warning that an invasion could take place within days.
If a Russian attack on Ukraine proceeds, it is likely to begin with aerial bombing and missile attacks that could obviously kill civilians without regard to their nationality. A subsequent ground invasion would involve the onslaught of a massive force, with virtually no notice.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has echoed those comments, saying that a Russian invasion could happen any time. The British Defense Secretary also made similar claims. The embassies of 10 countries, including the U.S., the U.K., Japan, and South Korea, have urged their citizens to leave Ukraine immediately. The U.S. State Department has even ordered its non-emergency embassy staffing Ukraine to leave. Washington has also decided to withdraw its staff working for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in Ukraine promptly. Now, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett says that the U.S. is lying about a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's also bribing and coercing its allies to do the same.
They're lying, very simply stated. They're lying through their teeth, and they know they're lying. And you can see that in their faces as they stutter and stammer and sweat and look down at the ground as they tell their lies. Everyone who's intelligent and who has worked in the military or the intelligence fields in America are all in agreement that this is a complete fraud. We've been talking about this for weeks. And what the U.S. Biden administration is doing is an old psychological warfare. The CIA and the United States are always notoriously bribing officials of other countries and at the same time threatening them with compromising video material that their leaders may have been cornered into doing. The Mossad are very good at doing things like that. So I think these other countries are saying the same thing that the U.S. wants them to say, and they're doing it out of a sense of gratuitous obedience. But when the rubber meets the road and the bullets are ready to fly, no country will take up arms against Russia. And in a sense, Russia has no interest in taking up arms against Ukraine. This has all been greatly distorted and invented by the West out of political desperation of the Biden administration, which is about to fall, I think, in the next year because of the damage.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The Taliban government in Afghanistan has condemned as theft and a sign of moral decay a recent decision by the United States to use billions of dollars of frozen Afghan assets to compensate the claimants of the September 11, 2001 attacks. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the website of Press TV. The piece is titled, "In Blocking Funds, U.S. Stealing Afghan Assets to Compensate 9/11 Claimants, Taliban." The Taliban government in Afghanistan has condemned as theft and a sign of moral decay a recent decision by the United States to use billions of dollars of frozen Afghan assets to compensate the claimants of the 11th of September 2001 attacks. The White House announced on Friday, 11th of February, that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden plans to block half of the $7 billion Afghan frozen funds in the United States banks to distribute among the families of the victims of the 9/11 attacks on American soil. Washington also claimed that the other half of the $7 billion would be allocated for humanitarian aid to Afghans suffering from the dire situation following the Taliban assuming power in Afghanistan in August of 2021. Sohail Shaheen, the Taliban's designated representative to the United Nations, called for the entire amount to be unfrozen and kept under the control of the Afghan Central Bank. The reserve is the property of the Afghanistan Bank and, by extension, the property of the people of Afghanistan. We want the unfreezing of the entire amount as a reserve of the Afghanistan Bank, Sohail Shaheen said. The spokesman of the Taliban's Doha office also blasted the U.S. move in a tweet, saying, "Stealing and takeover of frozen money, which belongs to the people of Afghanistan, by United States, shows the lowest level of human and moral decline in a country and a nation." The Biden administration has frozen the assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank since the withdrawal of its occupation forces from the country in August of 2021. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank have since then suspended activities in the war-ravaged country. Many of the U.S. allies and Western governments have also largely suspended their financial assistance to Afghanistan since the U.S. troop withdrawal and the Taliban takeover of the country. Aid agencies and the United Nations have estimated that more than half of Afghanistan's 38 million population is expected to face hunger this winter. Friday's decision by the Biden administration to block Afghan funds came as United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned on Wednesday that Afghanistan is hanging by a thread as millions struggle to survive and with education and social services on the brink of collapse. Antonio Guterres called for the release of frozen aid funds, warning that more than half of all Afghans face extreme levels of hunger, and some families are selling their babies to purchase food. Almost 5 months after the U.S.-led international coalition hastily abandoned the South Asian country, millions of Afghans are on the brink of starvation, with no food and no money. The Taliban's return to power came as the U.S. was in the middle of a chaotic troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. The group announced the formation of a caretaker government on 7th of September. But their efforts to stabilize the situation have so far been undermined by international sanctions as banks are running out of cash and Afghan civil servants are going unpaid. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order on Friday, 11th of February 2022, releasing $7 billion in frozen Afghan reserves to be split between humanitarian efforts for the Afghan people and relatives of 9/11 victims. In a highly unusual move, the convoluted plan is designed to tackle a myriad of legal bottlenecks stemming from the 2001 attacks and the chaotic end of America's 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, which ignited a humanitarian and political crisis in the country. But critics have warned that it could tip Afghanistan's already strained banking system over the edge into systemic failure and deepen a humanitarian crisis that has left millions of people facing starvation and almost the entire country, 98% of Afghanistan's population, short of food. You're talking about moving towards a total collapse of the banking system. Dr. Shah Mohammad Mehrabi, a longtime member of the Afghan Central Bank's board and economic professor at Montgomery College in Maryland, United States, told the New York Times. Dr. Shah Mohammad Mehrabi added, "I think it's a short-sighted view. Cash shortages have already led to strict weekly limits on how much of their savings the Afghan people can withdraw from banks, deepening the economic crisis in the country." In the United States, some 9/11 victims are actually arguing that the Afghan assets should all go to help the people of Afghanistan who are facing mounting hardship. The 9/11 victims deserve justice, but not from the Afghan people, who themselves became pawns caught in the middle of the US-led war on terror and an oppressive Taliban regime, said Adam Weinstein, research fellow at the Quincy Institute, who also served as a US Marine in Afghanistan. Adam Weinstein added, "The idea that overnight the central bank reserves went from belonging to the Afghan people to being the transferable property of the United States is nothing short of colonial. The money, which includes currency, bonds and gold, mostly comes from foreign exchange funds that accumulated over the past two decades when Western aid flowed into Afghanistan. But it also includes the savings of ordinary Afghans who are now facing severe economic hardship."
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir lahin rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali alayhi as-salam. Especially when it came to leadership, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, as we all know, after the death of the third Khalifa, he was pressured by people to accept the rulership, which he rejected without hesitation. When the Muslims saw Amir al-Mu'mineen rejecting this Khilafah, they pressured him even furthermore. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he said, "I will accept under one condition, that I establish justice that I do with you in the way that Allah wants me to do with you, in the tradition of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam and the words of the Quran. Those are my conditions. I will not be like those who before me, and I will not compromise on the truth or justice. I want to make sure that all the Muslims enjoy their rights equally under my command. If you guys are willing to accept, so be it. If you refuse, then I don't allow myself to be in such a position. For these reasons, he considered it to be obligatory upon him to accept the oath of allegiance, although many other righteous people at his time found themselves incapable of bearing the burden of Khilafah. It wasn't easy, because what Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi came to, the Khilafah only reached him, it was all over the place. The Muslims were divided. The wealth of the Muslim wasn't divided equally and fairly. Banu Umayyah were ruling most of the Muslim world. So no one wanted to take the burden and try to establish justice or anything in this regard, because obviously they weren't capable from every aspect of the word. But Amir al-Mu'mineen said, okay, I can do it. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he hated sequestered life, except when it was possible to serve the people by remaining in seclusion. It was impossible for him to spend his time in retirement. Prior to that, prior to Amir al-Mu'mineen being a Khalifa, he secluded himself away. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam had two choices. He could either break the peace of the Muslims and go to war with these people, or he could maintain the peace of Islam and the Muslims and seclude himself, which he did. But now it got to a stage where he had to make a stand. A person who neglects serving the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in spite of his being in a position to do so, spoils his faith as well as his world. If you have the chance and you can serve and you choose not to, then obviously there's a problem there that goes against your faith directly. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen is in a position where he can, and he has the power, he has the capacity, and he does so. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, now he's in a sensitive situation, in a very sensitive position, where he's about to accept the Khilafah, the rulership, under the condition that he applies justice fairly and equally to everyone under his command. So he accepted the Khilafah with firm determination and considered it to be the interests and considered it in the interests of the Muslims that he should assume office. Not in his own or for his own interest, but for the interest of the Muslims. This notion that we, when it comes to Khilafah, we see it's always the opposite with, let's say, 99.9 of rulers in the history of mankind, that when they want power and they want office, they want it for themselves. Now, they might clothe it and cover it and give it the garment of obviously trying to serve people. That's how people get elected, because if they say, no, I just want leadership and power, obviously no one would elect them. But when they come under the terms and the slogans that we're trying to serve you make your life better. We know best. We know how we can change things for you. Obviously, people get fooled by these slogans. But their inner reality, it's the desire to be in that position, position of power, position of rulership. So their interest is always first, not the interest of people. And this fact becomes very evident once these people assume position. Slowly, slowly, their true colors start to show. All the promises they have made disappears. And for the time they are ruling, you see people are suffering. Now, they might do a project here, a project there, just to keep people quiet. Obviously, this is required in order for them to maintain and prolong their office or their stay in office. But even that, it's not done for the people with the intention that it is for the interest of the people, but it is done for their own interest. So you see the difference between them and Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He says, sure, I will accept office. I will take rulership. I will become a ruler. But under the condition that it is what? For the interests of the Muslims, not for my interest, that I should not gain anything out of it. I'm not going to come and make my brothers and my cousins and my tribemen the leaders of different cities or the leaders of different sensitive positions. He did not do that. Unlike those who preceded him, where they made their family members rulers and governors of different cities around the Muslims. So they put their interests and the interests of the tribesmen before the interests of people and the Muslims as a whole. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 صل على محمد وآله.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A new analysis says from Germany to the United States, Australia to Italy, the cost of living is rising to new highs and causing new hardships. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Dominic Rush, Kate Connolly, Angela Giuffrida, Peter Hannum, and Hannah Ellis Peterson. The piece is titled The Rise in Global Inflation, The Hit to Living Standards Across the World. Please stay with us for more. After decades lurking in the shadows, inflation is back. On Amazon, you can find fridge magnets printed with words spoken 40 years ago by Ronald Reagan before the election that swept him into the White House. Inflation is as violent as a mugger, as frightening as an armed robber, and as deadly as a hitman. Price spirals remain a real fear for many Americans, particularly those who lived through the double-digit inflation suffered under Ronald Reagan's predecessor Jimmy Carter. What was a painful but distant memory is now a new reality, and it is global. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced on Thursday, 10th of February, that the Consumer Price Index rose year-on-year by 7.5% in January, a level not seen since the 1980s. Britain is not far behind, with prices rising by 5.4% at the end of last year. In the Eurozone, the 19 countries using the euro, it hit 5.1% in January, the highest level since records began in 1997. Here, The Guardian's foreign correspondent reports on how inflation is denting living standards around the world. For years, New Yorkers looking for a cheap eat have been able to rely on a $1 slice of pizza. Not for long, though. As inflation soars, even the cheap slice is under pressure, and many of the city's famous pizza shops are imposing price hikes to combat rising costs for everything from tomato sauce and pepperoni to labour and cardboard pizza boxes. US inflation hit its fastest pace since 1982 in January, pushing prices up at a 7.5% annual rate, the third straight month in which inflation exceeded an annualized rate of 6%. Supply chain issues coupled with rising demand continue to inflate the price of fuel, rent, food, and other essentials. According to Cox Automotive, the average price of a used car in the United States was $28,205 at the end of December, the first time the median price of a second-hand vehicle has surpassed $28,000. Price rises have hit everyone, but inflation hits poorer Americans hardest. According to the Labor Department's Consumer Expenditure Survey, the lowest-earning fifth of Americans already spend 83% of their income on housing, and can ill afford increase in rents, let alone increase in fuel costs, food, and other essentials. The US Federal Reserve is now preparing to raise interest rates in the hope of taming soaring prices. But with inflation surging worldwide, it remains to be seen how soon or whether the central bank will succeed. Italians have been feeling the knock-on effects of inflation mostly in their utilities bills, with gas and electricity costs rising by more than 50% this winter. In turn, the high energy costs have made it more expensive to run factories and transport goods, hence price rises have also been felt in other areas, such as in food prices and price of manufactured goods. Preliminary data from ISTAT, Italy's statistics agency, earlier this month showed inflation rose by 3.9% during 2021, hitting 4.2% in December, the highest rise in over a decade. The Bank of Italy predicts inflation at 2.8% this year, although businesses are forecasting higher price rises at 3.2%. Italy has not produced nuclear energy for more than three decades and is extremely dependent on energy imports. Marcello Missouri, an economics professor at Lewis University in Rome, said, "We're highly dependent on imported energy, hence why, from this point of view, Italy is more vulnerable than other countries." While forecasting that Europe's green and digital transition plan could impact prices further down the line, he said, "In the short term, there will be a great impact on utilities bills. I'm in favour of the two transitions, but in Europe, we are underassessing the possible medium-term impact." Inflation in Germany is currently around 4.9%, down on December's 5.3%, which was only the second time it has exceeded 5% since reunification of Germany in 1990, and is expected to remain high at least until the middle of the year. The Bundesbank referred to a consistent, extremely high price pressure in its January monthly report. There are multiple reasons behind the inflation rate in Germany, including supply chain issues, price rises to reflect losses linked to the pandemic, high demand for specific goods and services coupled with a labour shortage, as well as a rise in value-added tax rate, VAT rate, after it was temporarily reduced to help businesses last year. The most shocking hikes are for heating bills, petrol prices, diesel, electricity and oil, which, according to the Consumer Price Index, have increased on average by 18.3%, but in some cases by as much as 50%. On the grocery bill, consumers are paying around 6% more, but with big differences between goods. Potatoes are the big surprise, having risen by around 43% year-on-year, mainly due to bad weather conditions. Other foodstuffs such as tomatoes, salad, milk, onions and eggs have recorded considerable price rises of between 5% and 20%. In general, imports to Germany have increased in price by around 21%, the steepest rise since 1980, mainly due to supply chain issues linked to the coronavirus pandemic. While wages are expected to rise too in Germany, with trade unions insisting on appropriate increases, lower-income families are being hardest hit. Despite a 20% rise in the minimum wage in Germany, many are not expected to feel enough of a lift to be able to make up for the higher cost of living. For a commodity-based economy, Australia faces more of an uphill battle to keep a lid on prices than most. Consumer inflation accelerated at the end of 2021 by 3.5%, while the underlying rate watched by the central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia, rose to its highest level since mid-2014, at 2.6%. Record-high fuel prices were one factor. The Reserve Bank of Australia's monk-like forbearance to resist lifting the official cash rate from its record low 0.1% until wages start to rise at least 3% annually will be under the spotlight, with financial markets already pricing in the first hike in rates by June. Futures indicate by next February the rate would be as high as 1.25%. A rate rise delay until June, though, would at least avoid embarrassing the federal government in Australia, which must hold a national election on or before 21st of May. Private economists are less hawkish, but doubt that the Reserve Bank of Australia can hold off beyond August. One issue to watch is whether the jobless rate dips below 4%, which would be the lowest since 1974, although there are many reasons why wages growth may remain restrained, including the relatively weak bargaining position of the Labour Party in Australia. Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful tradition which has been narrated from Imam Reza alayhi salam regarding his son Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam. Here at Hadith of the Day and IRIB English Radio, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners on the birthday of Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth Imam of the family of the whole household of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful tradition regarding Imam Jawad alayhi salam from Imam Reza alayhi salam. A certain narrator named Yahya al-San'ani narrates the following. He says, I visited Abul Hasan al-Ridha, Imam Reza alayhi salam, when he was in Mecca. I saw him peel a banana and feed it to Abu Ja'far. And meaning the Imam alayhi salam peeled a banana and fed it to his son, Imam al-Jawad. I asked him, may I be your ransom? Is this the blessed newborn, al-Mawlud al-Mubarak? He said, yes, O Yahya. This is the newborn, the like of whom there is none other born into Islam, and upon our Shia more blessed than him. It's a very famous tradition in which the Imam alayhi salam characterizes his son, Imam Jawad, as being blessed, as being Mubarak. As you know, in Islamic terminology, or using a very famous Islamic term is barakat. Barakat refers to something which appears to be insignificant and small, but which has a lot of good effects to it. Has a lot of long lasting and permanent effects and benefits, and it has a lot of it gives a lot of good things to people, right? So the Imam alayhi salam, he characterizes the Imam with this term, right? He used to be a small child, appears to be insignificant, but has a lot of blessings for the Shia, has a lot of blessings for the lovers of wisdom and for humanity and in general. And this can be understood from and take into consideration the circumstances in which the Imam was born. If you're aware of Islamic history, you know that Imam Reza alayhi salam, he had his son, he was blessed with Imam Jawad alayhi salam in a very later stage of his life, to the extent that a lot of people were ridiculing the Imam and saying that the Imam doesn't have a son and the Imamat will not be passed down from him and will not continue. Right? So these were objections that people were mentioning to Imam Reza alayhi salam. And when Imam Jawad was born, these objections and this ridicule was terminated and finished. This is one of the blessings that came and accrued from this blessed Imam alayhi salam. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the blessings that Imam Jawad alayhi salam gave for people and for the Shia. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.